This is The Guardian.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. So Borussia Dortmund are in the Champions League final. Another brilliant performance, defensively excellent, controlled in midfield and a real threat going forward. And once again, PSG it. Has it got to the stage where we feel sorry for them? They hit the woodwork six times over two legs, a big win in Troy Townsend's world, but not in the one the rest of us live in. At the same time, it didn't feel like they were unlucky. Another disappointing night from Mbappe, Dembele, Ramos came in and didn't perform. So a Champions League final for Marco Reus to retire with. And what a game from Mats Hummels. 35, scoring the winner and leading from the back. To play like that at that age, stunning. Speaking of aging centre-backs, Johnny Evans and Casemiro. It's perhaps not fair to single them out, but a 4-0 defeat for Manchester United at the brilliant Crystal Palace is not ideal. Oliver Glasner's got something going. And quickly at Selhurst Park, we will try to talk about Palace for a bit before repeating ourselves about Manchester United. Then there's Moyes leaving West Ham and an excellent year for the East Anglia and Essex region in general. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, welcome.
Hi, Max.
Hello, Lars Sivertsen.
Hello, Max.
And hello, Jonathan Faduba.
Hello, Max.
Right, let's begin then at the Parc des Princes. PSG 0, Borussia Dortmund 1, Mats Hummels header in the 50th minute. So Dortmund go through 2-0 on aggregate to reach the Champions League final. Rob says, is there a name we can give the annual cultural holiday of PSG bottling the Champions League? The feast of smugness of Glendenning. Ian says, where would Barry place this particular PSG capitulation in the portfolio of PSG's greatest hits? It is the annual Let's Enjoy PSG crashing out of the Champions League pod. The novelty never wears off, Barry, does it? Or does it?
I wouldn't say this has gone in with a bullet, you know, at number one or four, or I wouldn't even describe it as a capitulation. I thought it was a pretty poor effort on their part. They're a goal down going into the second leg. I guess there's no need for them to panic, but it didn't even seem like they realised that they were in a Champions League semi-final second leg in which they were losing until about 15 minutes to go. They did nothing in the first half. I thought they should have, or I was surprised they didn't start with more intensity and give Borussia Dortmund, you know, plenty to worry about. But that just didn't happen before half time. And then when Borussia Dortmund scored quite early in the second half, that was more or less the tie over. Now, while I appreciate PSG did hit the woodwork four times in this game, it didn't feel like they were unlucky. They just weren't good enough. And once again, for the fourth Champions League game in a row, both legs of this game and both legs of the preceding game, Kylian Mbappe didn't stand up to be counted. He was very much on the fringes, a quite peripheral figure. And you know, these are the games he is supposed to win for PSG, and he didn't show up.
Can we talk about Dortmund? We will obviously go back into PSG, Lars. But they were so good again. They've been so good over these two legs. And it's actually quite hard to pick out. I started saying Mats Hummels, he was brilliant defensively with Schlotterbeck, Reyerson and Mattsson were brilliant in the midfield. And then I thought, I'm just listing the whole team. I did it after the first leg. But like, to a man, again, they really stood up.
Yeah, and it's been a confusing thing to watch because I've sort of slightly
arrogantly and rudely written them off many times this season in the Champions League, going, this isn't a good Dortmund team, because being one of these sort of Europe hipsters, I do watch the Bundesliga occasionally, where, believe me, they have not been great this season. They've been very underwhelming domestically, but there is something about these big European nights that they seem to just thrive on. Could talk about the tactical setup. Maybe this is a team that's actually slightly better suited to almost being an underdog, because they have sort of rugged but not very fast defenders. They have some quick players on the counter. Maybe that whole situation suits them better. But even beyond that, there just seems to be like a glint in their eye, and they just seem more up for it, which is such an unsatisfying piece of analysis, really. But when I've seen them in the Champions League, they just have looked a different team. And some of these players who have often disappointed in the last couple of years have really stepped up. And it was wonderful watching Hummels in this game. It was such an old-fashioned, like, the center house performance, just flying into everything, just clearing things here and there. Magnificent stuff. And for me, of course, watching Julian Riasson keep Mbappe quiet is quite something, because he's a fairly the right back who's from Norway. He's from a small place called Lyngdal. He's not a very glamorous character. Like, even by the standards of Norwegian fullbacks, he's a pretty low-key kind of guy. And actually, when he left Norway, he left his club, Viking, were in the second tier in Norway, and he went to Union Berlin, who were still in the second tier then. So when he went abroad to join second-tier Union Berlin, I don't think a lot of people thought this would end up with him sort of stifling the best player in the world and going to a Champions League final. That is a sort of minor fairy tale in the middle of everything. But he was great, and Dortmund did a very good job, I think, kind of funneling the attacks down the other flank. Like, I really felt... I don't disagree with Barry's assertion that Mbappe didn't show up, and it's always kind of funny to... But I also think this was a classic case of stopping the supply into him as well. I thought Dortmund were very, very good at, like, putting a lot of bodies around him. And, of course, if there's a lot of bodies around one player, that means there must inevitably be space somewhere else. So this really should have been a game for Ousmane Dembélé to sort of thrive, because he should have had more space, and Dortmund were so happy to just kind of funnel the game over to that flank. And he did not have a great game, Max. This is not a good one for Ousmane Dembélé.
He's had a terrible couple of games.
Yeah, he's so naturally gifted, you know, quick, technical, two-footed, but just makes a lot of strange decisions on a football pitch, and just, yeah, inconsistent. And they managed to put a lot of crosses in PSG, but really, if you got like Hummels and Schlotterbeck, and after a while they put Süle in there as well, like, you can put crosses in all day. Like, we're perfectly happy with that. Tactically, very well executed, incredible effort. And I just loved, lastly, I just love seeing them just all sprint to the away end at the final whistle. Like, the second the final whistle went, like, the whole back four and everyone who were in shot certainly just legged it to the away end, which I thought was lovely.
Yeah, it was beautiful. I loved Süle coming on for Sancho in the least like-for-like substitution that I believe I've ever seen in the game. And actually, you mentioned Sancho there. Jonathan, Adeyemi and Sancho, over both legs, so much more effective than Mbappe and Dembélé.
Certainly in the first leg, to an extent. I didn't think they had a massive impact on the second leg. But then again, neither did Mbappe. Obviously, Sancho was taken off early into the second half, as you just mentioned there, for Süle, which was a very strange change. I thought it was quite a big risk, really, because I felt that Dortmund were relatively comfortable at that point. And to sort of suddenly change the whole tactic and go to a sort of low block 5-3-2 and really sort of just have three big centre backs and just sit on the edge of their own box pretty much, I thought was quite a risk, and invited PSG onto them. But PSG just didn't have any kind of impetus to be able to get through that. And I suppose you could say the tactic worked in the end. Adeyemi, of course, it made me kind of chuckle a little bit how stunned Darren Fletcher and Ali McCoist were that he's quite quick. I think it was about the 60th time in two legs that they mentioned that he's got a bit of pace about him. He had an okay game, obviously forced a save from Donnarumma early on. Both of them had pace on the break. So I did think it was a bit of a risk from Dortmund, in the sense that they didn't really have much pace on the counter-attack in the latter stages of the game. So if PSG had got one back, it would have been quite interesting to see how the game would have developed. For me, it felt like Mbappe kind of... It felt like the end for me for Mbappe at PSG, in the sense that he just didn't have the teammates around him. I know a lot of people will blame him and say, well, he should have done more. I felt personally that he just didn't really have the team around him. Too much was expected of him, really, and Dortmund had a plan for that. If you look at the other flank, Dembélé, while he was so outstanding against Barcelona, one of his former clubs, against this former club, Dortmund. He didn't really do much. I thought that Barcola, kind of when he came on, didn't have a massive impact. Of course, Gonzalo Ramos, a lot was expected of him, the striker up front. He had a couple of half chances that he snatched at and didn't really make the most of. I didn't think he had a really big impact in terms of a physical presence or holding the ball up. I kind of felt a little bit sorry for Mbappe in that sense. I thought, you know, sometimes he can't do everything. He scored quite a few goals in this tournament. But you could argue again, you know, as Lars has mentioned there, with the likes of Ryerson and Hummels, he's not playing against sort of the, you know, Hummels is, while he's been had a magnificent career, and I thought he was magnificent. Him and Schlotterbeck, by the way, the centre-backs were fantastic. You know, you might expect Mbappe to do a little bit better against like a former Viking fullback. But all in all, and also one of the other things was he kept when the tactical changes were made, Luis Enrique put him back into sort of like a centre forward position as a number nine, and he was up against three centre-backs. So, yeah, all in all, I think Dortmund really managed the game well and fully deserving of a Champions League final. And, you know, a lot of the talk, the atmosphere was a lot of the talk of the game pre-match about the yellow wall and could PSG match that yellow wall. But I kind of agree with Barry. It had a bit of a, it didn't really rise to the occasion of the atmosphere inside the stadium. It really was, they were quite flat and didn't really have any urgency about them until, like Barry says, the last sort of 10, 15 minutes of the match, it felt.
Isn't the point with Mbappe that if you're the best player in the world, of course you can't do everything on your own, right? I mean, I suppose maybe we've just been spoiled because Messi could. But like, if you want to take over from him, if you want to be the best and you want to win Ballon d'Or after Ballon d'Or, these are the games, right, where you do have to turn up. You do have to suddenly do something that no one's expecting you to do. Lars?
Yeah, I completely agree. I don't love slaughtering a player for just not being able to do it in one game. Where things, but you know, you're completely right. I mean, there's a sense of where the bar is set. And I don't like the point that Jonathan makes about how it's all kind of on him. There aren't really any other like superstars in the team. It's well observed, but it is also, at least if reports are to be believed, it is what Mbappe wanted. I mean, if you go back to last autumn, about 18 months ago or something like that, for a while back anyway, there were all these leaks that he was unhappy at PSG because that was while sort of Messi and Neymar were still around, and he was sort of, well, I want to be like that. We should move away from this sort of superstar model, and I want more sort of young French players around me. Like he wanted to be the man. He wanted them to go in this direction. So you can't really then complain when it is all on you, because that's kind of what he wanted. And it is something that you opened with all the stuff about, are we all going to cackle with glee for 5 to 10 minutes because PSG have gone out? And I'm always up for that. But I do find that I feel slightly less like Schadenfreude than usual, because I do think this is now a less ridiculous team than it used to be. Like they've not just thrown a ton of money at random celebrities who are an obvious mismatch and who play bad football whilst like bored superstars, Hollywood people are spotted in the crowd. Like this sort of total nonsense period of the PSG project, I feel like we've moved out of, and they have at least put together a team that's sort of kind of makes sense. And it's gotten them to the semi-final, which is further than they usually go. But it does mean, yeah, maybe there is a lack of, you know, you've come around the other circle. You've gone too far. Maybe there's not enough superstardom in the team that used to have too much superstars. I don't know. Maybe this is a sort of a short blanket type of situation.
It's the interesting thing, Barry, about what people say about PSG, right? That part of the problem is they don't play in a competitive enough league, right? And then the same people or different people or some people are saying, look, the Premier League is too intense for European football, right? So does that mean the Bundesliga is in the perfect place? They're leading the Bundesliga in the perfect place where they're not so intense that you can have a few games that are easy, but it's intense enough that not every game is easy. So then you can do well in European competition.
Well, I think in terms of intensity, it's not how intense each game is. It's more the schedule. I mean, there are a lot of easy games in the Premier League because quite a few teams in the Premier League aren't very good. But I don't watch enough German football or French football to have any idea how intense it is on a game-by-game basis. But I would question whether that is the reason PSG go out on an annual basis. Look, the Champions League is quite hard to win, and if a couple of those shots that had hit the woodwork had bounced in a different direction, we could be having an entirely different conversation. But the fact of the matter is PSG are out again. And we have made the point that this is a much more likeable PSG team than ones of yore. And I, Luis Enrique seems like a really nice, interesting guy. But just Borussia Dortmund were better than them over two legs. And Füllkrug up front, I thought he deserved... I mean, it was a brilliant team performance from the goalkeeper all the way through, with some outstanding individual performances. And while he didn't score last night, I thought Füllkrug was excellent again, just the way he lumped the ball his way and it stuck, and he was able to help alleviate the pressure on them. But I just think PSG's approach to this game was all wrong. They should probably have thrown the kitchen sink at them from the start rather than in the last 10 minutes.
Totally agree with that. And also, as much as I think they're less ridiculous than they used to, they still have this sort of petulant streak, PSG. You know, towards the end, when things were really starting to get a bit dire because they'd conceded another goal and they were running out of time, we had like Dembele putting a nonsensical tackle on one of the Dortmund players, and like I wouldn't go so far as to say nearly got himself off, but that was sort of in orange card territory for me. And then you had Hakimi pushing someone for no reason. And I just was like, you guys realize that you are the team that's in a hurry here, right? Like, just causing these stupid situations will just allow the opponents to time waste. The sort of petulant crybaby side of this team is still there under the surface. And it kind of came out towards the end. A note on Jadon Sancho, who, you know, this wasn't as showy a performance as the first leg, of course, when he like completed something like 107 dribbles or whatever it was. But I just thought he put in such a good defensive shift, which should be credited, because, again, he's someone who's often sort of derided as being a lightweight and an inconsequential player. And I honestly have been slightly confused by the reaction in some parts of the British media to his performance in the first leg. Because honestly, if I was, as a Norwegian person, if one of our players had struggled the way Jadon Sancho has struggled for a period and then suddenly just dropped an absolute world-class performance in the semi-final, I would first of all be really happy. And second of all, I'd be curious to learn, like, what is it that Dortmund have done differently? Why have they been able to get so much more out of him? But every time I hear someone, an ex-player or anyone in the English media talk about it, it seems like they're more busy trying to talk about why it kind of doesn't count somehow. Like, I turned on the radio yesterday, and the first thing I heard was a former English player talk about, well, you see, it's easy for Sancho to play for Dortmund because there's just no pressure there. I was like, hang on. This is the second biggest club in Germany. Like, he played brilliantly in a Champions League semi-final in front of 80,000 people. Like, what are you talking about? Like, it's just weird that the attitude is to immediately explain why Sancho playing well for Dortmund somehow doesn't count, rather than just look out, hey, maybe there's something we can learn from this. Like, maybe just let's be more curious about why he's playing so much better there, and rather than just kind of dismiss it. This seems like a weird approach.
Word on Marco Reus, who has suffered so terrible injuries at like really bad times in his career, to get a Champions League final at Wembley. He probably won't start, but he'll probably come on. And if he wins it, you know, he was so close to winning the Bundesliga last year. Of course, Dortmund were. It was just wonderful to see him on that pitch. I thought Julian Brandt as well, who's such a brilliant footballer, was so good. Real Madrid played Bayern this evening, 2-2 after the first leg. How do you see it going, Jonathan?
I struggled to see anything but a Real Madrid win. However, having said that, there is a sneaky part of me that feels like Bayern Munich will win the Champions League, simply because if there's one thing Bayern Munich are good at doing, it's putting every other club in Germany in the shadows. And Bayer Leverkusen are about to go on to an unbeaten season, potentially. Had the best season in their history, pretty much. Also could get to the Europa League final. Dortmund have just got to the Champions League final, which has now taken a lot of the European spotlight. It would be classic Bayern to sort of rubbish all that by winning a Champions League, just say, forget all you lot, we're the number one. So I just feel like there might be a little twist in the tail there, potentially. However, Real Madrid, obviously at home, you have to think that they'd get the job done. They have that sort of magic power about them in the Champions League, where no matter how many shots you throw at them, they still sort of seem to be able to deal with it and come out triumphant. I think it'll be a really good, entertaining game. I think tactically, Thomas Tuchel is one of the best managers in Europe. And I think in one-off games like this, he's really, really good. I think that's when he's at his best. So I feel like they'll have a plan. It's just a case of how effective will it be? How clinical can they be? And obviously, do they get the luck they need at a team like Real Madrid? I think it'll be a fantastic game. I did want to say a little thing about Sancho. I know we're going to come on to Manchester United in a little bit.
Oh, please do. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's just a bad look for Erik ten Hag, isn't it? I mean, that is a bad look. Seeing Sancho dancing on a table, celebrating getting to a Champions League final the night after you've been slapped 4-0 is a bad, bad look.
But was he on time? Was he on time for dancing on the table? That's the question. Well, look, hold that thought and we'll do Manchester United in part two.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Now, Barry, Guardian Football Weekly has discovered something called social media, right? Feels like something that will be very positive for the world. You can now find Football Weekly on Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube. Just search the Guardian Football Weekly or follow links in the description of this episode. We'll be sharing clips from the show, asking you for questions, sharing some behind the scenes and live show footage as well. Barry, we are pioneers of the internet.
Fantastic, yes. I'm speechless. I don't really know what TikTok is yet, but I'm hugely looking forward to, I imagine it's something that when young people see what we're doing,
yeah,
they'll all clamber aboard the TikTok bandwagon as well.
I would have thought so. Never have you sounded like an old man
when,
in your entire life.
When you say behind the scenes footage, That just sent me into a massive panic.
I don't know. I'm just reading what Joel wrote. I don't know what those things are either, to be honest. Yes, Lars?
It's kind of hard to gauge what our audience is because we just kind of sit down and record this and then it goes out on the internet and we never know if anyone's even listening. But we have done live shows, of course. You guys have done a bunch of them. I've done a couple. So I've seen sort of roughly what the sort of average age and composition of the people at the live shows is. And based on that, I think there's no real need for us to put anything on TikTok. I'm not sure.
Oh,
maybe.
Oh, ye of little faith. You just watch those numbers go through the roof. We'll be doing synchronized dances before you know it. Anyway, let's go to Monday Night Football. Crystal Palace 4, Manchester United 0. Stuart says, remember when David De Gea was the problem at Manchester United? Just simpler times. Crystal Palace have done the double over Manchester United this season. And actually, they were favourites to win this game, Palace, before it. And we should, before Jonathan goes on a long Manchester United, completely acceptable and justifiable, I don't know if it's a rant or a deconstruction, we should say, Barry, and lots of people wanted to say, can you please just mention Crystal Palace? They were brilliant in this game. And like Glasner has them going. Elise and Eze are brilliant. Wharton looks like like my favourite centre mid already. Like they were so good in this game.
Yeah, and I was sort of making a mental note watching this game. Don't let this bit of the pod be all about how bad Manchester United were, because Crystal Palace were quite simply outstanding and they bullied Manchester United. Like Manchester United, they were just bullied by Palace. And we know how good Eberechi Eze is. We know how good Michael Olise is. Adam Wharton has been fantastic. He's just made the transition from lower-end championship team to mid-table Premier League team. Just made it look absolutely effortless. And he's one of the Palace's outstanding players already. And Oliver Glasner has done a fine job there. But I think the way he's getting a tune out of some of the other Palace players who aren't as celebrated as the ones I've just mentioned is what's really impressed me. Like, Will Hughes always seemed to be quite peripheral player under Hodgson. I don't know if it was to do with injuries or just Hodgson didn't particularly fancy him, but he hasn't done a huge amount since signing for Palace from Watford, I think it was. But he's been brilliant. Joel Ward has slotted seamlessly into this new system of, or adapted to this system of Glasner's. Tariq Mitchell, Chris Richards, just the ones we would normally sort of dismiss as the supporting cast. And they are still, to an extent, the supporting cast, but they're all just playing so well under Oliver Glasner. They seem to have completely bought into his philosophy. And what, they've won 4 of the last 5 games, I think, and just hugely impressive. And the worry, as is always the case for teams like this, is who are we going to lose during the summer? What players will we be able to hold on to? Because the Sharks will definitely be circling around several of their players. And I think they might need to offload one or two to fund this refurb they're doing at Selhurst Park, which has been sort of threatening to happen for quite a few years now. So they're finally going to increase the capacity. But yeah, a massively impressive performance from them. And I was laughing, like literally laughing out loud at the way in which several United players were just bullied by their opposite numbers.
Mm. Paul says, given the project that Glasner's embarking on with Palace and the way Eze and Elise just know what each other's going to do, would they be better off staying off for another season at Palace rather than jumping ship to Spurs or United, who seem less likely to win anything themselves? Lars, what do you think?
Well, it's you'd have to ask them a little bit in terms of where they feel they're at in their career path and their plans, because it's easy to say that after a 4-0 win against Man United, and it's obviously very, very exciting right now, but I'm sure those are two very ambitious young men who want to play at a higher level. But you make the point that you want to be careful with where you leave for. I think Palace look like a team that's going to be a perfectly decent mid-table team next season. So if the people who are coming in for you are offering a potential to finish a couple of places higher and make a little bit more money, then that might not be that exciting. But I think both of those have the potential and are good enough to play for teams that challenge for trophies, you know, insert joke about Tottenham here. So I think they'll be of interest to even bigger clubs than the aforementioned Spurs, and it's a tough thing to turn down to. But it would be very frustrating if one or both of them left this summer, because it feels like we've only seen glimpses of them playing together, because there's been so many injuries this season, and we're now seeing them play together for a manager who's not Roy Hodgson, and that immediately looks very exciting. So I feel like that's something, as a neutral, I'm not even a Palace fan, just as a neutral, it's something I'd like to see happen more times before they're split up. And just very quickly, word on Jean-Philippe Mateta. That second goal was amazing. Like, the guy's right-footed. Like, he's got no business pulling off that finish for the second. Yeah. And he's turning into one of these players who just...
Yeah.
Logically, my brain knows that he can't be that good, because, like, I can see what the numbers are. But he just seems to play well almost every time I watch Powers. I think that's a coincidence. You sometimes get these with players. I went through a whole spell of thinking Shane Long was very good, because he just seemed to play very good every time I watched West Brom for a period. Clearly, Shane Long, not that great. But yeah, if maybe I'm like a good luck charm for Mr. Mateta. Maybe Palace should get me into the fancy seats regularly at Selhurst Park.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't tell him that you also are a good luck charm for Shane Long.
I'm taking grave exception to this traducing of Shane Long. how dare you?
He
just
had a time, didn't he, when he didn't score a lot of goals. Anyway, on to Manchester United, Jonathan. This was Johnny Liu writing. The reliable Johnny Evans reliably perched 10 yards behind the rest of his defence as if auditioning to be the drummer. The forlorn sight of Casemiro sliding in on Michael Olise on Monday night, and not just missing Olise, but the memory of Olise, like a man walking into a room and immediately forgetting why he entered it. I mean, you don't have to start with Johnny Evans and Casemiro, Jonathan. I don't know where you want to start with this result and just the malaise at Manchester United.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I'm allowed to say a little bit about Palace as well.
Oh, yeah, okay, if you want to.
I suppose I could come back to them, but yeah, on Olise and Eze, I just, my overriding feeling from it was, I just think that's such a joy to watch. And it made me think, I mentioned it on a social media platform, that, you know, I wonder how many youth coaches, both of them went through four academies when they were emerging. And I wonder how many youth coaches told them, like, stop showboating, or, you know, like, that's too many tricks. And just watching that game, they just made the effervescence they had, they just made the game so exciting to watch. And I feel like sometimes watching Premier League matches, we lack a little bit of that in terms of that flair and that excitement that you want to see. Coming on to Manchester United, well, where do you even start? I kind of agree with a lot of people tweeting in, you know, it's almost boring now talking about how bad they are really.
It's not boring for anyone who was growing up in the 90s.
Yeah,
let me tell you.
I just can't get over the image of Sancho dancing on a table. To me, that just sums up Manchester United this season, really. Like, he wasn't even allowed to go into the canteen to get, like, to get crisps.
To get near a table.
Yeah.
For half of the season. Because he was such a naughty boy at Manchester United, apparently. And then to see him such a sort of, like, positive... have such a positive influence on the Champions League semi-final and just seemingly so happy, it just paints the contrast to me, really, of like how there's definitely something going wrong at Old Trafford. I mean, you talk about sort of Eze or Olise and people say, well, Manchester United might try to sign them. But I can imagine a scenario where Olise goes to Manchester United and just has a miserable time and is terrible. Like, there's no... It's gone way beyond the point of this is a player issue, in my opinion, where you can sort of point the finger at players and say they're not doing enough. Maybe Casemiro, but to be honest, that was coming when you're spending sort of 70 million on an aging player. That was obviously going to be one, you just kick it down the road. And they knew they'd kick the can down the road, thought they'd get one good season out of him. And now they're paying the price for that. And he's got time left on his contract. Eriksen, a 3-year deal when... You know, at the time, it was Brentford who were the main team that were really interested in him. There's just a collection of bad recruitment decisions. But I think it is way beyond a player issue now. And I do sort of find it a bit strange where I saw one sort of pundit last night saying that Ten Hag's done a reasonably good job. And it makes me sort of question my own sanity at times, because I think he's done a comfortably worse job this season than David Moyes' first season at Manchester United, when everyone was unanimously decided that he was a terrible, one of the worst managers ever in United's history, if that makes sense. And Ten Hag's managed to outdo him, just how badly United have been. It's really hard to sort of point fingers at where the problem lies. But I really, because obviously Ten Hag is also in a situation where maybe he's suffering in that environment. And it's really hard to know what is this sort of strange thing at the heart of the club that is making it so toxic. That obviously the Glazers is what most people point the finger at, but they can't be having that bad, much of an influence over everything, surely, can they, to be that bad? So, yeah, it's a strange one. United on the night were just terrible, awful, like one of the worst displays you can see. No kind of, just nothing about them, just a ball of nothingness. Palace was so good and so flamboyant to watch that it just made it even worse in a way. It was like watching Torvald and Dean and then watching two people in a park like swinging punches at each other. Like just the contrast was so enormous.
Actually, I'm trying to wonder which I'd prefer out of those two things.
But I mean,
anyway, chanced upon them.
If both are supposed to be skating, Max, then you know, I mean, like,
right? Okay, right. I understand now. I mean, Jamie Carragher said, "This is one of the most poorly coached teams in the Premier League. That is a fact. You have to make us believe there is something there. I'd expect Manchester United's under 23s not to lose 4-0 like that. I've been coached by some top coaches, and a lot of what I see here is just wrong. I think, and there's a question, Lars, about." Obviously, there are injuries, right? Johnny Evans and Casemiro is not who he'd want to play at centre-back, right? They have all sorts of injuries. They haven't had a left-back for however long. But at the same time, they're still playing this kind of attackers press high, midfielders don't. There's a huge gap there. Like, you have to be pragmatic, surely.
Yeah, it's the donut formation. Ten Hag seems very keen on it. Like, just no players in the middle. It's very confusing. I don't think I've ever seen a supposed top team ever try that? And for this game, it was a perfect storm, right? You have still insists on pressing pretty high with those forwards. Defenders will sit back because they're slow and not very good. And so you make a massive hole in the middle that you're now attempting to fill with poor Kobbie Mainoo, who's very young and still, you know, a little bit wet round, yeah, still a bit sort of inexperienced. And Eriksen, who's not really, you know, someone who, you know, I think we all like as a player and as a character, but doesn't really have the legs anymore. So it's just a perfect storm. And the players who are there to sort of fill that hole is Eze on Elise. Like, this is not good. And you mentioned the center halves. I mean, this is where I have some sympathy with Erik ten Hag. That's probably, what, their sixth and seventh choice center halves, I think. I mean, it'll be Martinez and Varane if they're fit, but they never are. And then there's, like, Lindelof and Maguire would be the backups. And then Kambwala probably is in there now, having played quite well. So that gets us to Eriksen and out of position Casemiro as, like, the sixth and seventh option in defense. Evans reportedly also not fully fit for this game. And Casemiro clearly not a center half. So there are very few squads in the world where you can take out, like, five center halves of the equation and what happens afterwards is any good. Like, this is where we should have some sympathy with it. But I just don't understand this insistence on playing and setting the team up in a way that's just not conducive to getting results. Usually you try to set up a team in a way to kind of hide your flaws and accentuate your strengths, right? Well, this just doesn't do that. It is sort of making, if the flaws are an unreliable back line and sort of a lack of dynamism in the middle, the donut formation makes that look so much worse. Like, I don't understand the thinking behind it. And I didn't think the sort of interview, like, to be fair to him, he did sit down with Gary Neville and talk for quite a while, but I just didn't think the answers were very convincing when he was asked about this. Neville was kind of poking and prodding a little bit about the sort of bizarro tactical situation. And he seemed to say something to Ten Hag about, well, we want to press high and we don't want to confuse the players by changing strategy. And I thought it was deeply unimpressive. And they're a total, total mess.
Yeah. I mean, at least Ten Hag did say they were bad, which is a real sign that they were bad after a game.
that is a relief, because he seemed like increasingly deluded recently.
So the thing is, I was listening to Andy Mitten, Barry, from United We Stand, saying that obviously there's lots of hope with the new owners coming in, but that some staff there are sort of seeing these, you know, all staff emails from Big Sir Jim saying you've got to sit at your desk and you've got to stay at home, and all being a bit like, oh, I'm not sure I love this new broom, actually. And, you know, what you have to kind of create, the whole point is everyone says, well, it's too much that it's not a player thing. It's not a manager thing. It's something grander than all of this. So they have to carry everybody at this enormous, like, there's a lot of employees there in Manchester and in London. They've got to carry them all with them somehow.
Yeah, to do. I mean, United fans were just desperate for anyone to go in there and start influence and take charge of football matters. I don't think they particularly cared who was going to be, just as long as it was just somebody new. Now, I've made my grave reservations over Sir Dave Brailsford quite clear, and I'm not going to go over it again, but he may very well do a good job. I personally have my doubts. We'll see. He could prove me wrong. He may prove me right. Sir Jim Ratcliffe apparently, you know, did a tour of the facilities and was unimpressed with the state of the IT department and the dressing rooms of the younger teams. They were, you know, squalid by all accounts, and that's not good enough. And, you know, fine, tidy them up, and it's good to have everything clean and ship shape, but that's not really one of the big problems United are facing. I think Erik ten Hag will probably be fired, whether he wins the FA Cup or not. Then who do you get in? They need a lot of new players. They need to ship out a lot of dead wood. They need to sort out the recruitment. I mean, I think it was accompanying the Guardian match report for this game. There was one picture, I think it was after Mateta's goal went in, and it was just a picture of Casemiro, Johnny Evans, Anthony, and somebody else all standing around looking sad, and you're going, well, you know, that, oh, it's Christian Eriksen. And you're going, well, there's four of the major problems right there for, you know, one reason or other. There's just so much wrong at that club. It's an absolute shambles. But it's going to be really interesting to see what happens going forward.
Jonathan, like the next manager, I mean, do you think Ten Hag will go one? And like Tuchel is the favourite, then Southgate, then Potter, then De Zerbi. I mean, it's obviously hard with these because you don't know who really writes these lists. And, you know, that may not be the shortlist, but they're quite different managers, right? And sort of Tuchel coming into this sort of Ineos-y organisation just doesn't feel like it's exactly the sort of thing that would work.
Yeah, I think Tuchel would be the number one choice. I think he's the obvious one in the sense of someone who could change things around. I could see him sorting it out tactically. I think Southgate seems to be the one, the outside one, I think it could have a chance of happening because there just seems to be this sort of soft, launchy feel about the rumours on that are emerging on social media. Like, you know, when you put out a story and then see how it lands and see how people take to it. And it just seems to be floating around. I don't think necessarily he, you know, while he's an okay coach, I don't think he's the answer at United at this time. I think that it needs like a kind of a, not necessarily a strong man manager, but it needs someone who can go in there like Tuchel and just rip things up because, you know, you just mentioned tactically United conceding goals is fine. When, you know, Lars talks about the defence and having no centre-backs, which you can understand that from that point of view. But that's not the issue, I think. The issue is, I was looking at Mikel Arteta's early part of his time at Arsenal. So they finished eighth in the first two seasons under Arteta and didn't do a huge amount in terms of league finishes. But the thing with Arteta is the first season, they massively improved their defence. So although they didn't, you know, improve holistically overall, you could see an immediate improvement in their defensive shape. And it kind of went from there. Then it was, oh, they can't score goals. And season by season, he's worked on it. People say about Ten Hag, he wants to play this high press. United don't know how to press. Then people say, well, he's a possession coach from the Ajax school of things. The worst thing for me about that Palace game was every single time United regained possession, they lost it within about two passes. Like you couldn't talk about defending, but there's zero ability to keep the ball. And that is almost every single game you watch with United. They don't know how to keep the ball. So, yeah, I kind of agree with Barry. Like, I think, and then it's also the press conferences and the kind of just borderline delusion of saying the game, you know, played well or we're the most entertaining team in the league when they, you know, they've got a negative goal difference. So yeah, I think he's really not helping himself in that sense. And that Sancho dancing on the table, I'll go back to it. That does not help your cause, does it? You know, the person that you've decided is the problem of the bad egg of the club that we need to get rid of has just gone on to hugely better things within months. I think that for me personally, it would be Tuchel. I think he'd be the one that I'd look at. I think he's the one outstanding coach on the market. But, you know, when you look at someone, even Glasner going back to Palace and how well they've done, you know, Glasner got Wolfsburg into the Europe. He's won things at Frankfurt. And the thing with him and the contrast to me is he's implemented a style at Palace there within sort of 2-3 months. It's not, if you're a top coach, it can't be that difficult to mould players into a sort of fairly cohesive unit. I don't buy the argument that it's all the players and he needs like a million new players that they're saying. I just don't buy that because there's no identifiable style of play that you can sort of hang it out on and say, well, there's something to build on there at all. It seems to just get worse and worse. So going back to your original question, sorry, Southgate seems to be the Ineos. I feel like he's the company face that I could see happening, but I don't think that would necessarily go too well. I think someone like Tuchel would be a better choice.
Yeah, and that, I mean, that has, there has been sort of renewed chatter on the rumour mill last couple of days. Southgate chatter has intensified and an element of Chinese whispers to it, but, you know, certainly it seems to be a school of thought that Southgate is the man, put it that way. And just briefly on that, that just seems like such a, to decide that now seems wild to me. Now, I know Barney wrote a piece on why it makes sense and made the case for it. I just think you've got to think of, if your plan is to appoint Southgate ahead of next season, you do know that there's something happening between now and then, right? You're aware that there is like a small football tournament of which Gareth Southgate will be involved in some capacity being played out between now and the start of next season. Because you may think, let's say England win the Euros And Southgate steps away.
Of course they will.
Yeah, of course. It comes home and Southgate steps away, you know, job done, and goes straight into the Man United job as like the triumphant England manager who I can see why that is an attractive scenario. But let's face it.
That really is not an attractive scenario.
But let's face it, it's also not.
I cannot think of a less attractive scenario.
There's also a pretty good chance that doesn't happen, right? And the expectations for England in this tournament are so high. I think anything other than getting to the final, maybe getting knocked out in the semis by someone really good, but anything other than that will be seen as a huge disaster, and Southgate will then be seen as like a failure, a flop, a traitor, like all these sort of weird things that the press comes up with. And then you go from that, being the guy who couldn't get it done with the greatest England generation since blah, 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 blah. And now he's the new Man United manager. Like, that, you have a complete sort of PR disaster right off the bat. Like, this is going to be...
God, getting booed at every ground.
I mean, yeah, it's going to be a total...
Like, he goes to, oh, I can't handle it.
Now, that's kind of irrational and weird and not fully Southgate's fault, but that is a very possible way that that could go. So if the rumors that they've already decided on Southgate are true, then again, I would really question whether they've thought this through, whether they understand how any of the mechanisms around elite level football work, whether they have any comprehension. If that's true, I really question the sort of... I question a lot about the new regime if that's true that they've made that decision now.
All right then, well, we'll see. Well, yeah, that'll do for part two. Part three will begin with news about the Guardian Football Weekly book.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Barry, we've been nominated for Sports Entertainment Book of the Year, up against Phil Tufnell, QI, and Gary Newbon. The first, the first entertaining book that Jonathan Wilson has been involved in. That is for sure, isn't it?
Hey!
Yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, and is that kind of humour you will get in the Guardian Football Weekly book?
Exactly. You can vote for us by going to sportsbookawards.com or check my Twitter or Wilson's Twitter. It's a public vote for us, not a public vote for Football Book of the Year, Lars. And your book, Erling Haaland. Yeah. Haaland is up for that. And who are the judges? Do we know who's going to judge it? Who can we pay?
I don't know.
Anyway, good luck to you, Lars. And good luck to Susie Rack.
Thank you.
In the children's sports book category.
Didn't she write it in conjunction or collaboration with one of the lionesses?
Leah Williamson,
that's her, yeah.
Yes, she did. Oh, well, good luck to the pair of them. Right, West Ham have confirmed David Moyes is going to leave at the end of the season. Jurno Lopetegui is reported to be close to signing a deal to take over. Moyes said, "I've enjoyed 4.5 brilliant years at West Ham. The club's in a stronger position than when I returned back in 2019. Lars, he is right about that, isn't he? And we have talked at length about Moyes. And he won them a trophy. West Ham don't win trophies. It's a great achievement. But the writing's been on the wall for a long time. Is Lopetegui the Spanish David Moyes?"
I think it's a bit harsh, but I think he's feels like in sort of aggressively meh appointment. Like, I'm really sort of... I understand why you would want to move away from Moyes, even though he has done a good job and all the things we've talked about, like this has done a good job. The football's boring. We've had this conversation so many times. I get why you would move away from that. But then I was kind of hoping they'd appoint someone exciting and interesting, because, you know, you already got some pretty cool players there. And, you know, your London club, they have a bit of money. Like, there's potential for West Ham to be a really cool team and an interesting place. And I don't think he's bad. I don't think he'll make them terrible. It's not an appointment that really excites me. He's a pretty defensive coach.
It's funny. They brought in someone down on defensive. Like, that is funny, isn't it? All these West Ham fans just raging at being quite successful, more successful than they normally are, because they're dour and defensive. And that's what they're going to do again.
I don't get it. I don't understand why you would do this. That's my main reply. Like, why? I don't see the logic in it. Now, again, I don't think he'll make them terrible and get them relegated. I'm sure they'll finish mid-table next season and it'll be fine. But it's just, why? is my overriding feeling.
You know what? I was really baffled at why West Ham fans were dissatisfied with Moyes after winning a European trophy for them just about a year ago. And I just couldn't really understand it. Even the league position he had, you know, he's got them to, and you struggle to think how someone else could come in and do a much better job. And then I sat through that Leverkusen West Ham first leg, and honestly, it was a 90-minute rewiring of my brain, and I fully understood why West Ham fans were feeling that way because of the approach. So I suppose it speaks to modern football, isn't it? Like, people don't, survival or doing okay or finishing eighth isn't really the story anymore. People want to be entertained. If you're going to be paying the kind of money you're paying to watch Premier League football these days, there's a part of the contract, I think, says that I'd like to see something quite fun, please. And that Leverkusen game, I thought West Ham could have approached it in a different way, and maybe, you know, the second leg almost showed that they could have offered a lot more with the players they have. So, yeah, it's a mutual parting of ways, isn't it, really? I do feel sorry for David Moyes in the sense, because he's a really good coach, and I think that he will do a job, and I think he will find if he wants a Premier League job again, I think he'll get one. But I guess, you know, I do think it speaks more about the demands of the modern fan. They want to see something entertaining and see some joie de vivre, I guess, and they didn't, they weren't just not getting that from Moyes. So in terms of Lopetegui, I don't really have a massive opinion on him. I think I kind of go along with Lars says, to be honest. I think the jury's kind of out on him in terms of different stages of his career. He's had different success levels, so I can't really pin down exactly what he's about, but he did okay at Wolves.
I absolutely am here for Vladimir Soufal knocking it long for Mikel Antony on the opening day under a new manager, just hearing the London Stadium going, oh, so this is what we're getting. Alex says, why have Hull sacked Liam Rossini? Andy says, Liam Rossini being sacked has made me very sad indeed. Has any managerial departure ever left you feeling heartbroken? Have you ever been heartbroken, Barry, by a Sunderland manager getting the bullet?
No, just by women, various women.
Oh, well, don't worry about it. So try and bring the mood back up now while discussing the sacking of Liam.
Now,
Liam
this
Rossini.
Is what we need to put on TikTok. We need Barry's love life diaries on TikTok. Advice to the young men: learn from my mistakes and my
like
and my
Hitch,
crimes.
Like Will Smith Barry in Glendinny. Hitch. That's what you could be, Barry.
Yeah.
Anyway, Hull said in a statement, since Liam's arrival, we've enjoyed an open working relationship. I don't want to talk about open relationships on that previous
thing.
Anyway.
They've both been seeing other people.
Exactly, yeah. Progress has undoubtedly been made over the course of his tenure. He will always be... Yeah, he was just coaching Rotherham at the same time. We didn't care, but it turns out that was a bad idea. He will always be a part of this family, and I thank him for all his work. It's become evident that our visions for the future are not aligned, and I feel that now's the time to make a change. Our philosophy is clear. We will continue to drive this club forward. Whilst doing so, we'll continue to be open and transparent with our fans. Listening to a sort of people who know more about this, is that he's a brilliantly well-spoken coach. He's incredibly popular. I think he's done a really good job, but they weren't always brilliant. I think it's sort of not the total travesty that I thought, but I'm still surprised that he got sacked.
Well, I think everyone seems to love Liam Rossini. I've never met him. He seems like a top bloke, seems like a decent manager. I think he's been a bit unlucky in the latter stages of this season with injuries. So he has Aaron Connolly. He's a Hull striker now, the Irish fellow who sort of briefly shone at Brighton before sort of fading into obscurity for a while. He's been out injured now. I don't know how good he is. Liam Delap was there on loan from City, isn't it? And he's been out injured. So that's going to cost some goals. I think the interesting part of that statement from the owner is that our visions for the future are not aligned. I'd like to know more detail about that. Like, he's done a decent job at Hull. He signed a 3-year contract in December, so presumably he's in line for a nice payoff. I guess he'll get another job somewhere else. So he leaves with his head held high, his reputation intact, and it's probably not that big a deal.
I think you might be right. Yeah, good luck to him. I totally agree on everything you said. Again, not man, but just comes across brilliantly, and hope he gets another job soon. Charlie says, can we get an in-depth review on Mark Bonner after his move to Gillingham? Yes, Cambridge United legend Mark Bonner's joined Gillingham. He's very good, and I think he'll have a good time, and I wish him all the best. Is that in-depth enough? In the EFL, Bolton 2, Barnsley 3 last night, which means Bolton go through 5-4 in aggregate in the League One playoff. They'll play either Oxford, hopefully, or Peterborough in the final. Oxford are one up on that. Crawley beat MK Dons 3-0 in League 2 in the first leg. Doncaster beat Crewe 2-0 on Monday. I'm told, Jonathan, there is no time for Essex and East Anglia having a successful time and the surrounding environs, unless you can do it in 1 minute. All the teams that have done well in this new hotbed of football.
Could do it in 30 seconds.
Brilliant.
Ipswich Town promoted with close to 100 points. Braintree Town promoted from the National League South to the National League on Monday in a final against Worthing. Needham Market promoted from the 7th tier to the 6th tier after winning the league. Great Wakering Rovers against Romford is the FA Vars final at Wembley. Two Essex teams. Colchester stayed up and Norwich are in the playoffs, championship playoffs. So for the rump of England, it's been a pretty bootylicious year.
Absolutely. Cambridge stayed up. Northampton sort of in East Anglia, sort of, like, depends on where you draw the line. They were for Anglia news purposes when they were desperate for some goals. Bobby Barnes missing a penalty on the old cricket pitch. Northampton.
Are things going well for Southend as well?
Yeah.
They survived. They haven't gone bust.
Oblivion.
Wow. Yep. This is the future.
They nearly got in the playoffs with the points deduction.
Yeah, they did.
But they just narrowly missed out.
Finally, Colin says, what did Barry make of Equaliser 3? Personally, I enjoyed it. Relatively basic premise, but well executed. Gave the fans what they want.
I also enjoyed it. It was certainly better than the second half of... Well, I'm guessing it was certainly better than the second half of Wolves Man City. I only saw highlights of that. But it would be my least favourite of the three Equaliser movies so far.
Could you give me just a tiny... For someone who's never watched the Equaliser movie, would you be spoiling it if you told me just a vague idea of what it is? I mean, it's not just somebody scoring a late...
Basically, Denzel Washington is an...
He's a journeyman striker who scores late on to get a share of the spoils for Stevenage in a League One match. And then he goes to another club and scores another equaliser. I can't wait. Sorry, do carry on.
He's an Uber-driving vigilante who sticks up for the little guy and is incredibly violent. Oh. Yeah, except he's not an Uber-driving vigilante in the latest...
Oh, has he done the knowledge? Has he done the knowledge?
He's done the knowledge. Now he's driving a black cab.
Oh, excellent. Oh, I look forward to watching all of those. And that'll do for today's podcast. Thank you, Barry.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lars.
Thank you, Max.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Thank you, Max.
Football Weekly is produced by Joel Grove. Our executive producer is Danielle Stevens.
This is The Guardian.